Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, if you were accused in an official inquiry of bullying your staff, would you resign?
Oh my goodness. Are you trying to tell me something, Jimmy? Have I hurt you in some way, shape or form? Jimmy, if I hurt you, it wasn't my intention. And I'm so sorry if I have hurt you. Well, God, are we role-playing? What are we doing? Oh, this is fun.
So long as it wasn't intentional, I think we can just move past this, Jazza. I don't think it matters.
Okay, cool. Are you sure your feelings aren't still hurt?
Well, they might still be hurt, but they were unintentionally hurt, so it doesn't really matter, does it? It's not important at all. Jazza... Sorry, I had to end this somehow. We meet roughly every week at the moment for some reason, not usually, but to discuss politics, current affairs and social issues. And as acute listeners might have gathered from that conversation, one of the things we're going to be discussing
that
this week...
That terrible improvised sketch that I think it really just does say that we should never do anything on stage together, ever.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's something to work on, I think, at least. But
something to work
as,
on.
As listeners may have gathered, we're talking about Priti Patel, who is still the Home Secretary of the United Kingdom and was slammed, I think is the official journalistic term, in an independent report saying that she was bullying her staff and yet has still not resigned, Jazza.
No, and has the backing of the Prime Minister. So there was an independent... Well, no, it's not an independent inquiry, is it? It's like an inquiry by the civil service by an individual called Sir Alex Allen, who is famous, amongst other things, for once... what's it called? Windsurfing. Christ.
He's famous for windsurfing.
He's famous for windsurfing along the Thames into work in like the 70s or the 80s or something when the trains were on strike. Fun little fact for you there.
That's a very fun fact.
That is a fun fact. But he wrote a report saying, there's this thing called the minister's code, the ministerial code, that basically says, don't bully. That's shit, isn't it? And he concluded that she probably had bullied them, maybe unintentionally, but she was pretty shit to work for. Maybe she's unfit to be one of the most important ministers in the government, based on how she treats people. And then the Prime Minister went, oh, you know what, I've read the report as well, and I think the opposite thing is Sir Alex. So there you go, still got pretty around, and then Alex left.
I mean, he's a very bad loser on Sir Alex's part, just quitting just because he didn't get his own way. What sort of sportsmanship is that?
I don't know. I think you kind of have to quit after, like, you've done the report. You've gone, okay, so this is what I think should happen. And then the person who you give the report goes, no.
Okay, well, we can talk about that in more depth when we get to the actual segment. As well as the Priti Patel scandal, we are going to be discussing Mr. Macron, the president of France.
Oh, Macron!
Oui, oui.
From whose party is called? En Marche!
Yes, yeah, that one. He said some interesting things recently about Islamism and Islam in the context of the French Republic, specifically that he is going to be announcing laws and various measures to essentially crack down on the kind of expression of Islam in public context. So there's already sort of rules around what religious symbols you can wear when you're doing public duties. Those are going to be strengthened. And he's also issued a challenge to French Muslim leaders to sort of reconcile the apparent tension between Islam as a religion and the concept of secularism in France. Jazza, this is actually something you suggested, even though it's clearly going to upset you when we discuss it, because it involves Islam and specifically my general scepticism of the religion. Why did you choose to do this to yourself?
Well, because I thought that the listeners probably like it.
Yeah, I mean, listeners, you can confirm or deny that one way or the other, in either by sending us a tweet or writing in some fashion.
That would be nice. Pen and paper, please. That'd be quite good.
I assume that we're going to be discussing, how we feel about this, whether we think it's going to be an effective strategy for Emmanuel Macron.
Yeah, I kind of want to put it in a little bit of context as well, because France has had a really shit few years, has had more deaths from terrorism than any other Western nation, I believe, in the last 5 years. And there's this kind of like concept of, they call it laïcité, which is basically secularism. Why does it have to be a different word, guys? Come on. we'll be talking about how that is maybe not helping things with the Muslim population in France and now across the world, because Macron seems to have pissed everybody off, so that's fun.
Well, I mean, it's good to have some sort of outcome from this sort of process. And Jazza, what's the last thing we're going to be discussing on this here podcast?
Well, every now and again, I like to suggest a topic that is basically just me playing, putting together like my fantasy football team, but for politics. So whether that is my ideal cabinet. I'm surprised I haven't suggested that we do one for Joe Biden's cabinet, actually. That would be exciting. Maybe we'll do that next week.
Something for a Christmas special, perhaps.
Oh, yeah. A nice treat. We just so happen to have had a really great catalyst for this very type of conversation. Political hypothetical, if I were ruling the world, with Boris Johnson saying that in a private meeting with Conservatives north of the border, he said that devolution was one of Tony Blair's biggest mistakes, which has then promptly pissed off all of Scotland and I think increased the polling of saying yes to independence by about 10 points. So I want us to talk about what an ideal, whether or not devolution seems to have quote-unquote worked, and what our ideal devolution would look like for the UK. Sound good?
Yeah, that all sounds very good to me.
Oh, fun.
Fun times. Jazza, should we ask the listeners for some contributions and play some music and then get on with the podcast?
I'd like that. You make it sound so quaint with ask for some contributions. It really sounds like we're passing around a wicker basket at a church.
That is pretty much what's happening.
Oh, okay, cool. Thanks.
If you're enjoying the Right Dishonourable podcast, and I'm assuming that you are since you've made it this far, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable, where you can donate money on an episodic basis. We've decided that we're going to be uploading bonus segments for our patrons' ears only, so if you'd like to listen to those, then I suggest you go onto that Patreon page and sign up as soon as possible. As always, we'd like to thank our existing patrons, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, Gemma Cumming, John O, and Matt.
Jimmy, if you were unable to get into work by normal means, what would be the quirkiest mode of transport that you would take?
I think I would organise for a private helicopter to pick me up, and then I would parachute down from it.
Oh, kind of like James Bond and the Queen, the opening ceremony of the Olympics in 2012.
Very similar to that. Actually, rather than a helicopter, I think I would take a hot air balloon. I think that would be better.
Oh, I do quite like that. That's
potentially more affordable as well, I'd have thought, and probably less likely to crash, let's be realistic here.
Is it?
I mean, helicopters crash all the time. Like, it's almost a standard rock star death, actually dying in a helicopter crash.
I have a feeling that hot air balloons also crash quite a lot. You have a lot less agency over your movement with a hot air balloon.
That is a downside, I'm not going to lie. I'll look into it and get back to you as to got to consider safety in these things. Was there a point to this question?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to talk about the fact that Sir Alex Allen, who is the 69-year-old civil servant who wrote up this report on Priti Patel possibly being a bully to her staff. I just wanted to bring up the fact that he wants windsurfed into work again, because I think that that just tells you everything you need to know about a man, doesn't it, really?
Can we trust a man who windsails into work?
No, but is he going to be fun at a dinner party? Fuck yeah.
So are we disparaging this report on the basis that the mode of transport of the author is something we disapprove of?
No, entirely opposite. How do I don't understand how you can think that that was my conclusion to this. But if anything, anything that Alex says need, and we are on first name terms, thank you. I don't even need to call him sir. I will listen to everything he says with bated breath. This is about one of the most powerful people in government, the Home Secretary, being really inappropriate at work. Why is Boris Johnson kind of like nailing his colours to her mast, for want of a better word?
Well, I mean, that sounds a little bit saucy in context.
I mean, I've been watching too much Little Britain, not Little Britain, Spitting Image.
Which is actually quite good. I caught a couple of episodes of it last week, and I think they've done a reasonable job despite the scepticism. But that put to one side, I think it's one of the things it kind of reminded me of, because the report does say that Priti Patel used to shout and swear at her staff, and I've sort of got a guilty pleasure in watching old Gordon Ramsay documentaries occasionally. If you remember the Kitchen Nightmares one, where he there's one previous to that called Boiling Point, where he was pursuing his Michelin for like his third Michelin star, I can't remember. And it's what made his name, because he was infamous for shouting and swearing at his staff. And there's one episode, if I recall correctly, where a waiter fucks up an order at a table and is just sacked on the spot, basically. And I remember what I watched it like a year or two ago, and I thought, there's no way you'd get away with this shit now. Like, it's just like way too savage and brutal. And it turns out I was wrong. You can still behave like a total shit. And
yeah, but
nothing
also
will happen.
There's a difference between a TV show that's there for entertainment and being the Home Secretary of the United Kingdom. So
yeah.
some people may kind of like look at this report and say that it's civil servants being too delicate, too snowflakey, whatever. I know a few people who have actually worked with Priti Patel, and I've known that she is terrible to work for a few years. I think since she's been Home Secretary. No, even longer than that, when she was like in the was it DFID that she was in?
It was DFID before, yeah.
She is renowned by people who work in the civil service to be an absolutely appalling person to work for, and just a bit of a shit. Now, I don't think that it's necessarily a bad thing if somebody is a bit of a shit at their job, as long as they get shit done. But I think that bullying is kind of like a different level. Like, I don't think people should keep their jobs if they are known to bully and then don't rectify their behaviour. There are like a number of, I can't remember the name of the civil servant who kind of like kicked off all of this, who resigned after working with Priti Patel.
It's Philip Rutnam is the guy you're thinking of.
Thank you.
He's currently suing the Home Office for constructive dismissal.
Yeah. And so he has said that he'd brought up Patel's behaviour multiple times and she hadn't changed it.
This is one of the things that Alex Allen says in the report, though, that she wasn't fully aware of the kind of the effect that she was having on staff. Although I find that part of the report just baffling, because if you're giving someone a bollocking, you must know that you'd have to be totally inept not to know what effect that's going to have.
If you are shouting and swearing at people, how can you not? I am sorry, it is 2020. We aren't in like the 1980s when everybody's coked up and earning like millions of pounds a second. That's not what work life is meant to be like anymore. But also, what is the role for bullies in our society, Jimmy? This is kind of like one of the things that I was like curious about. I don't think the public are really going to care about this. And I think there's going to be a certain amount of kind of like snowflakeism in like the press.
The Telegraph editorial has already been written, if not already published.
All of the kind of like university graduates and fast track civil servants can't handle kind of like a good bollocking by somebody who is assertive and is like a hard-nosed boss. But it's really shit being on the receiving end of that, and it's terrible for mental health. And the fact that you can have all of these, like, there is this big shift towards kind of like a greater awareness of mental health, especially for like men's mental health in a lot of like right wing media nowadays. And then on the other, you can say that it's okay to be a bully. Like, I don't understand how they can hold those two things in at the same time.
Well, I mean, apart from anything else, Philip Rutnam, if you've seen a photograph of him, is hardly a spring chicken. I don't think he would qualify as a millennial, although I know a lot of millennials have mortgages and kids now. I don't think he would be bracketed that way. But I mean, as you say, if she was getting results at the Home Office, if people felt it was a well-running department, you might be able to excuse it in a way. And I mean, there is an unfortunate thing in all sorts of organizations where if somebody's talented, they're given a free ride in terms of their personal behavior. I think the examples of that sort of don't need to be stated. But
are you talking about Steve Jobs?
I mean Steve Jobs is kind of an interesting example, but I was also thinking of Harvey Weinstein in a sort of wider context.
Oh, that's a lot darker.
It is a lot darker. But I suppose the other thing is that there is a bit of the trouble with, I guess, a lot of this stuff is that there's some people that can take being sworn at and they kind of don't really care, and there's other people who it will affect quite severely. But so I guess there is sort of room for misunderstandings and all that kind of thing. But I've got to think, I mean, the Home Secretary, as you say, is one of the most powerful people in the country. I think you really should have your management chops down by the time you get nominated for a role like that. And I think there's been a lot said about Boris Johnson essentially just picking Brexiteers for his cabinet. That is obviously true, and that's why certain people have been chosen who otherwise might not have been. I've just got to think there's got to be a better way to actually appoint cabinet ministers. It's just in general, I think that is sort of what this shows up most of all.
Well, it's the civil service is meant to kind of like correct for the ineptitude of cabinet ministers, right? Like, cabinet ministers are political appointments. They don't actually really have to make stuff happen very much. Like, that is the civil service's job, and one of the reasons why the UK is pretty good at getting stuff done. Like, in the US, the equivalent of the civil service completely leaves at the end of every administration if it changes parties. And so there isn't kind of like that institutional memory or know-how on how to get stuff done, whereas in the UK we don't have that, and there's this kind of like you basically inherit in perpetuity kind of like a staff every time there's a new person in the post, and the minister is meant to kind of like say do this, and then they're meant to do it. But I've heard people suggest that it is just because, and I don't know, it's possible that some of this is kind of like based in a bit of sexism, I'm not sure. I unfortunately have not had the privilege of meeting the lady, but she, I've heard people suggest that she's just really, really out of her depth, that she isn't that good, and she's just really incompetent, and then she takes it out on people. But also we should remember that this is the lady who was who lost her job under David Cameron's premiership.
You're thinking of Theresa when she was working with Theresa.
Oh, was it Theresa May? Yeah. And she had she didn't disclose meetings that she had when she was, I think, at DFID. She had secret meetings with the Israeli government.
Yep, that is correct.
Which is, again, against the ministerial code.
Yeah, I mean, I think when she was sacked that time, it was sort of assumed that she would wendle her way back into government somehow, and obviously she did do that eventually as the Home Secretary. But yeah, I mean, she has form on this. I mean, she also has form even before the Philip Rutnam case. There were kind of other reports of, I mean, a lot of this stuff was just hearsay, which I'm still going to pass on because why not? about her in kind of previous jobs where it was felt she didn't have a particularly professional, method of conducting herself. The sexism angle is kind of interesting, I think. I mean,
it's what a lot of conservative commentators have actually responded
saying
that a lot of these allegations are based in sexism and racism. And the fact that she isn't from kind of like the kind of background that a lot of, at least the grandees of the civil service are from.
I mean, who knows, really? It's I've not seen any public information that would verify that one way or the other. It seems to me to be grasping at straws, really. And, you know, even if people don't like her for those sort of reasons, there's still been an independent investigation that has concluded that she's not very pleasant to work for. It seems fairly straightforward to me that is the case. You know,
why is Boris Johnson keeping her?
I mean, I guess the conventional answer is that he wants to keep hold of Brexiteers in his cabinet. It would also look particularly bad. He's lost his chief advisor last week. Do you really want to lose a Home Secretary? I mean, not even last week, sort of, you know, within the same week practically. Is that something you want to do? You begin to look very, very incompetent if you... I mean, he already looks incompetent for various reasons, but...
imagine the Prime Minister of Great Britain looking incompetent. Close your eyes, if you will.
I mean, it would be interesting to know in an alternate universe if Dominic Cummings was still in office, whether Priti Patel would have gone. I think it probably would have been more likely because I think... I mean, presumably he would have had a view, and I don't know how tight they are, and also, you know, the situation would have looked a bit different. I don't know. I mean, what's your kind of read on the situation?
I think I probably agree with you in terms of he wouldn't be able, he can't lose his senior advisor and his Home Secretary in 2 weeks, and. I would expect there to be a reshuffle in the near future, but now is just not convenient for him, and so he had to go against Sir Alex the Windsurfer's suggestions, and he had to be like, well, I can't do it now, so I'm just going to reject his conclusions. But also, where is the HR saying this person needs to be sacked or needs to not have this role?
Well, from what I've read, the Prime Minister is the ultimate arbiter. He's
the one who decides.
I mean, that's like the chief exec being the head of HR. You've got to have an independent head of HR. What's the point?
Yeah, but this isn't HR. This isn't I hate to break it to you, but this isn't a private corporation.
So what? do you know what I mean? That's like the shittest answer. I mean, it is sort of fair in a way. Like a lot, I think people. I guess this is sort of getting into the weeds of corporate governance, which is kind of boring at the best of times. But politics in Britain is so unprofessional because it all started like on a handshake 400 years ago or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like it's so uncodified and so haphazard. We sort of seen the same thing in the kind of parliamentary bullying allegations about, say, John Bercow, the former speaker and his and staff in the House of Commons. And the process, from what I can tell, just needs to be professionalised in some way. I mean, the ministerial code was...
What do you mean by professionalised?
As in, you need to, like, the PM shouldn't be allowed to mark his own homework if, you know, a report is being filed against his Home Secretary. That should clearly fall under the remit of somebody else who is at least somewhat independent of you know, whoever is Prime Minister at that point. Just basic stuff like that, you know, just separation of powers, checks and balances, all of that sort of thing.
Ken Clark, who is the granddad of Ramona's, he was saying that he was like harking back to a time where if this kind of thing had come out in the good old days, then the minister would have fallen on their sword and they would have resigned. What do you think? Why do you think that kind of stuff doesn't happen anymore?
I'm not really sure that I buy that. I think actually in some ways processes have been improved since the days of Ken Clark, who was Chancellor under Margaret Thatcher, among other things. I mean, the ministerial code, I think, was only published under Gordon Brown. So who was Prime Minister between 2007 to 2010. That tells you something in and of itself. I mean, I think that, and there's all sorts of, I think if you sort of spoke to somebody who's, say, a civil servant who's been in politics 30, 40 years, I'd be very surprised if they told you things were less professional than they were back under Margaret Thatcher. Maybe they were in certain respects, but I don't really buy it as a whole. But it's, in some ways, I guess, to answer the particulars of the question, this government just doesn't really have any shame. Like, it's that whole, like... I sort of dislike the general tendency to draw parallels between Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, but there is an attitude that if you just don't give a shit, you can wait out pretty much any complaint and it doesn't really matter. Which is, I think that is true to some degree. I think that is an identifiable phenomenon.
Yeah. Remember they provoked Parliament?
Yeah. Yeah.
Fucking hell.
Crazy. We should. Is there anything else you wanna touch on? I think the sort of badness of this. We should have found someone who thinks that you know, Priti Patel should stay in office to counterbalance things. But it kind of seems self evident to me that this is wrong. But
yeah.
What do I know?
Not very much. On va donc continuer et parler de Emmanuel Macron, le président de France.
We're going to continue by talking about Emmanuel Macron.
Who is the president of France. Yes, that... Oh, very good, Jim. Well done. You get an A star for your GCSE French.
Thank you very much.
So, Emmanuel Macron was very popular at the moment across the Muslim world. They're burning effigies of him from Pakistan to Turkey.
I mean, that's brand recognition, that is. I mean, how many Western leaders can claim that people will burn effigies of them in foreign countries?
In foreign countries. I do remember when Theresa May was burned as an effigy for bonfire night in that place in, I think it's in Surrey, is it?
It's Lewes in Sussex is the one you're
in
thinking
Sussex.
Of.
Sussex, yeah. They burn an effigy of just someone they don't like.
They burn
effigies
of everyone in that town.
Yeah, they did the Pope one year.
Boris Johnson's definitely been done as well.
Oh, 100%.
I'm sure,
yeah,
David Cameron and George, maybe even George Osborne.
But yeah, those in power. So actually, it's just like, it just says that Macron's part of the zeitgeist. But he's pissed off quite a lot of the Muslim world by suggesting that Islam is in is having a global crisis. And really doubling down on some of the problems that France has been having in the face of kind of like poverty, especially with their Muslim populations and extremism within their Muslim citizens. It kind of, the most horrific part of it is this is when it came to a head with the murder of a school teacher called Samuel Paty. Have you heard about this?
I have heard about this, yeah.
Where he was teaching civics, which, as you know, is one of the worst subjects to teach.
I think it's probably taken a bit more seriously in France than it is in Britain.
It probably is. We don't have a constitution, do we? Right. But he showed a couple of images of the Prophet Muhammad as represented by Charlie Hebdo, who are the satirical and sometimes bleeding over into pretty inappropriate.
No, he actually showed the Danish Muhammad cartoons.
Was it the Danish one? No, one of them was Je suis Charlie.
Okay, fair enough.
And then I don't know what the other one is. The other one, I think, was like a pretty bad depiction. Or I think it showed Muhammad in a pretty terrible light. When he did this, he told all of the students, if you'd rather not see these images, then close your eyes or turn around. And then word got out. Some Facebook posts were made. Some extremist leaders said some words. And then a guy who spoke Russian killed him by chopping his head off. And this was a secondary school teacher, which is pretty fucking terrifying, actually, when you think about it. He was just doing his job, and he was doing his job, it sounds like, pretty damn respectfully. But then also there's kind of like the Bataclan attacks, where so many people died in, like, I think, was it 2016?
I was going to say 15, but yeah, a couple of years
15
ago.
15 or 16. And then there were the two recent attacks as well in France from extremists. In the face of that, Macron has started to say that they really need to kind of like clamp down on a lot of the ghettoization, I think is the word that he has used, of a lot of Muslim people in France. He is bringing in a load of initiatives such as stopping people from being able to homeschool. I can't think of the other ones off the top of my head, but a lot of things that go against what you probably say is kind of like religious and individual freedom. And freedom of speech and things like that. Ironically, this goes, he's doubling down on this concept of laïcité, which is basically, it means secularism, but it means a bit more than that in France, where basically, in order to have complete freedom, they think that you have to tell people that they can't do things in public places. And your freedom, it's a weird concept of freedom, France, I'll be honest. But basically, you aren't allowed to, in public places such as schools, have anything religious whatsoever. So that means no headscarves, no nativities, no crosses, skull caps if you're Jewish, etc., etc., etc. You can only do that in the private sphere. Also, Macron is looking for re-election next year.
I think it's 2022, actually. I don't think.
Is it 2022? Yeah, that's what I was going to look up, and I forgot to.
Dear. Well, you'll know for next time. Always Google your facts. I mean, I think you haven't said it in so many words, but there is an interesting contrast between how England and America, let's say, views freedom of religion, which is, I guess it's kind of best expressed in the American Constitution. Congress shall make no law forbidding the practice of religion, or some words to those effects. I mean, it's about sort of, well, to use a French phrase, ironically, a laissez-faire approach to from the government towards religion. You can establish religion, freedom of worship, and it's quite common in sort of the US to sort of go down the road, and you'll see sort of multiple churches like on the blocks across from one another. And religion is very, very prominent in American public life as well.
God save America.
God save America, and God bless America as well.
Oh yeah.
All that kind of thing. As you say, the French have a much more assertive form of state secularism, the contrast is interesting. And as you say, it does effectively involve various encroachments on what we would understand as freedom, the freedom to
dress however the bloody hell you want.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how widely this was enacted, because it was one of those sort of funny stories that you read in the British press, and it's difficult to know what entirely to make of it. But it was this whole thing around the burkini, which is like a a modest version of a bikini, let's say.
It's a full body cover. It's kind of like, it looks a little bit like a wetsuit.
Yeah, yeah. And this apparently is banned in various regions in France because the French really believe in nudity, I guess.
The reason that it is banned is because it's seen as a religious item, a religious symbol. But then if it's in a public place, this is what I don't really understand about it. Like, in order for them to, they are so militant about this concept of laïcité that it objectively takes away people's freedoms, but they say that they're doing it in the name of freedom, so that everybody can be free. And that isn't freedom.
Well, it is freedom in the sense that they're trying to limit the influence of religion, which they see as corrosive to freedom in general. They are preventing it from having any role in the public sphere.
But all that has done is made it easier for Muslim people, and especially those who are from families of immigrants, and who are from poorer backgrounds and live in what they're called the banlieue, which are kind of like the
suburbs.
It's kind of like a council housing, and cheap housing. It makes it so much easier for them to be kind of like cornered off and have their own spheres because their religion isn't able to be kind of like visible in so many places in France. There was large numbers of kind of like there's loads of studies showing that if you have a Muslim name or if you are if you look like you're from an Arab background, you face a huge amount of discrimination in France. Like the this concept of laïcité really does have a huge, it comes into huge conflict with the way that Islam seems to be wanted to be practiced by a large portion of its population. That is, but however, though, there are kind of like a huge majority of Muslims, I understand from some polling, although who believes the polls anymore? Like something like over 80% of French Muslims support like laïcité, secularism in some way, shape or form. But a lot of people, even non-Muslims, believe it should be reformed reformed to be less of a blunt instrument. But yeah, like there's, it's kind of like, it's similar with any forms of extremism. There's this population that just have not been able to engage with the wider community. And so extremists are able to go, oh, go and cut this guy's head off. That will make it better.
I don't know, because I think one of the interesting things about the contrast between the French approach to secularism and the British approach, I mean, Britain is not an officially secular state, but in practice, it is quite a secular country. And
I always find that so interesting.
Like, well, yeah, I mean, we're much more, there's much less religion in our politics than there is in American politics. I'm aware that I'm slightly obscuring the case with Northern Ireland, where that obviously isn't true. But it's very rare. Obviously, Boris Johnson doesn't exactly seem like the most devout man on the planet. But even someone like David Cameron, who is a bit more milquetoast, said his religious views were kind of like his belief in Christianity was like a radio service in the Chilterns. It kind of came in and out.
Mm-hmm. Famously, Tony Blair was Catholic and felt like he couldn't come out as Catholic until he left the post of Prime Minister.
Well, I think Alistair Campbell was asked about religion, and he replied, "We don't do God," or something like that. So it is very different in Britain, but Britain has similar problems with its Muslim community in terms of extremism.
Nowhere near what France is dealing with. Like a lot of the same things, like there are parallels certainly, there's nowhere near the same amount of eventual kind of like problems with religious extremism and with terrorist attacks and things like that. I think France is very much a special case.
I don't think it is, to be honest with you. I can't really see that. I mean, you know, the kind of Islamist terrorist attacks in Britain are, you know, they'll be pretty well known to our listeners but I'm sure if you compare like for like, I'm definitely willing to believe that France has suffered worse terrorist attacks in relation to Islamists, but France has a different security situation to us, and they have land borders with Belgium, which is where, you know, some of the Bataclan attackers came from. So I don't think you can put that down purely to their secularist policy.
I really think that is the thing that kind of like, that's the special sauce that makes it even worse. I think our version of like the murder of Samuel Paty is the people protesting compulsory LGBT sex education in schools. Like they're nuts, but nobody's like hurt anybody yet.
Not physically, no. But I mean, at the same time, you know, it kind of counters your thesis that if people were only allowed to practice their religion freely, then we'd all be happy families. Clearly that isn't true. Clearly there's something more
I still maintain that it would probably be better if you are not telling people that they have to kind of like restrict themselves. Like it would be like telling I don't know. It would be like telling a trans person that they can only present themselves as their gender. No, it's not like that at all. Never mind. No. Never mind.
Back
bad
away,
bad
back
analogy.
Away, back away. I don't. Well, yeah. I guess we'll just have to agree to disagree. But I suppose it's some people have actually almost said. That the French republicanism and laïcité is itself, it's almost its own form of religion, which, you know, is something people say a lot about, you know, non-religious phenomenon in general to try and sound smart. And mm-hmm.
Like the NHS.
That.
The NHS is our one.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Mm. I don't know. I think there is an inherent tension between people who are very religious, and I'm not just singling out Islam here. I think the same is true of, say, American evangelicals, for instance, and secular states. There's always going to be a tension between those two things, because ultimately, if you believe in a, you know, divine doctrine, and you think that there's a certain way people should be living, there are some people who follow that belief who will think that secularism is wrong, and who will want to overturn that. And I think that's a tension you kind of have to put up with if you're going to have sort of religious communities in your country. I think it's kind of inevitable.
If you're going to, what's the solution? Communism.
Communism, which has never been compared to a religion ever.
Ever, no.
Ever, ever, ever. There's no good segue here, as per usual. speaking of dealing with, you know, difficult communities, Boris Johnson, Scotland Jazzer.
Yeah, I feel like if there's gonna man, it's a mess, isn't it? So he, in a private setting, speaking with Scottish Conservative Party members, was it, or was it members of the
MSP? Scottish MPs, I think.
Yeah, Scottish MPs. He said that. He said that devolution was Tony Blair's biggest mistake. Devolution obviously created the Parliament of Scotland, the now called Parliament of Wales, and kind of like the power share agreements in Northern Ireland. And he's now gone back and said that it is what he meant to say was the way that devolution has been done. Is going badly because
specifically he said the way the SNP, the Scottish Nationalist Party, has handled devolution has been a disaster. That's a direct quote.
Yeah, but it was so easy for it to then be construed as him saying that Scottish people shouldn't be able to govern their own things.
Immediately, really... I think the guy's name is Douglas Ross, the leader of the Scottish Tories, said no, devolution hasn't been a disaster. The SNP have been a disaster, and this was before Boris Johnson's clarification. It was when the leaked comments were just being reported. Mm. But you know, from the Tories' point of view, or at least from Boris Johnson's point of view, it has created a huge problem for them because I think. Maybe this is too simplistic, but I think without the Holyrood Parliament, there'd probably be less support for Scottish independence. I don't know.
Yeah, 100%. It wouldn't have the same platform. Yeah. Before the Holyrood Parliament, the SNP were a fringe group who got like 4 MPs each election. Mm. Never really very much more than well, in my lifetime anyway. It was tiny, tiny, tiny party. And then because of the Holyrood elections, the local elections in Scotland being proportional as well, so therefore you are not restricted, smaller parties are able to gain traction because they're not suppressed by first past the post, they were able to not only gain like increase in size, have a larger platform, but also they've been able to govern for how long? A decade? Is it over a decade?
It must be now, I think. Quite famously, it was sort of set up to... It's a proportional system, so in theory, nobody should get a majority in Holyrood's Parliament, but the SNP have had one for a while, you know, pre-Nicola Sturgeon anyway. So yeah, I mean, it's I think the general effect of it has been to push push Scotland towards independence, which, as I said before, is not really ideal. A lot of the sort of even non-Tory critics of the SNP will say that they've also presided over falling education standards. Education seems to be one of the big things. There's been criticism about, I think, the way that the police have been reorganised. There's now sort of a Scottish-wide police service, I think I'm correct in saying.
Just to correct, I don't. The SNP don't have a majority.
Oh, they don't anymore. Yeah, that's right.
They have a minority government.
But they did have a majority for a while, didn't they, under Alex Salmond, I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah, I think in the last parliament they had a majority, and then they lost it, losing mainly to the Conservatives.
Yeah, that's right. And they also obviously have most of the MPs in the Westminster Parliament for Scotland as well. So it's kind of a one-party state, really, in some ways.
Yeah, it really is.
So, yeah, I can see why Johnson would have said that. He probably shouldn't have said that. I mean, he didn't say it publicly initially. He said it in a private conversation that was leaked, but he probably shouldn't have said it in even a semi-private forum, I don't think. And politically, as you said, you've said that some of the polling reflects a backlash against that. And even the Scottish Tory leader has kind of denounced those comments as well. So it's not good all round. You said that you wanted to kind of use this topic to lay out your personal vision for how devolution should be handled going forward. So maybe now's a good time. You can tell Boris Johnson what you think he should do in order to save the union.
Well, Jimmy, I'm glad you asked, and thank you for listening, Mr. Johnson. I've laid it out before, and I will lay it out again. Basically, we've done this in a very British way by just kind of like adding a little bit here, adding a little bit there, and not actually having a big holistic view of how we want to have any kind of devolved government in this country. We have national parliaments for Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. And then we have metro mayors, for Bristol and for Birmingham.
Greater
and
Manchester.
Manchester and...
Sheffield as well.
Yeah, I think so.
Liverpool.
We've got the Greater London Authority. Wait, no. It is the GLA, right?
I think it is the GLA, yeah.
Yeah. Who roll up into the Mayor of London. It's an absolute bloody mess. What we need, I will tell you now.
Is it a constitutional convention? And then a musical written about the Constitutional Convention.
Oh, I'd bloody love that. I mean, who's going to be our Alexander Hamilton? I reckon Ruth Davis. She's a great character. Ruth Davidson. There you go. But basically, I have said this before. The European Union required us to think a little bit more smartly and a little bit more nuancedly about how we represent ourselves in a proportionate and fair system. So we had the UK split up into how many different constituencies was it? UK in EU Parliament.
I'm glad you've done this research ahead of time so that we don't have to interrupt the podcast for you to Google something.
Oh, I hate you. So I can't remember how many sections the UK was cut up into, but it was basically based broadly around population. It was Scotland was one, Northern Ireland was another, then there was Wales, then there was London, and then there was South East of England, South West of England, North East, North West. And those, by kind of like broadly by population and by culture, those kind of groupings of England and the splitting off of England make sense. The problem is we have no devolution really in England apart from the metro mayors. But that means that there are so many different gaps in our legislative practices when it comes to England specifically. We have the only way that health policy, for example, or transport policy in England is dealt with is through, if you don't have a metro mayor or you don't have a mayor, is through the Westminster Parliament. That means that Scottish and Welsh and Northern Irish MPs vote on whether or not there is going to be a hospital in Bedfordshire.
I mean, wasn't that undone? Nobody ever talks about it now, by the whole English vote for English laws thing, or EVIL, as the acronym is spelt.
English votes for English laws.
Which is still in play, I think. I've got a vague feeling that William Hague was involved in, like, ushering it through. Maybe that's wrong. He was Foreign Secretary. But, yeah, I mean, in theory, to actually pass certain... to pass things that will only affect England in the Westminster Parliament, a majority of English MPs has to sign off on it, which...
It looks like that is still true.
Yeah, which in practice... Because the Tories have effectively a permanent majority in England, it remains to be seen how that will affect how a Labour government governs England from Westminster. But that problem has not yet surfaced. But
what a shame it's called EVIL.
Yeah, didn't think it through.
But there just isn't kind of like there isn't a counterbalance to Scotland, really. That it is the UK versus the UK government versus the Scottish government. The Welsh government doesn't have the same amount of kind of like clout or power, and I mean Northern Ireland is a whole fucking mess. And so everything is kind of like Nicola Sturgeon versus Boris Johnson at the moment, or Nicola Sturgeon versus whoever is in the position of Prime Minister at that time. And that itself, the ability that she is able to put herself up against kind of like the UK-wide Prime Minister, allows them to make the case for stuff like independence a lot more firmly and a lot more clearly, because there isn't kind of like this idea of Scotland, Wales, maybe the northeastern governor or whatever it would be called, or the northeastern first minister, kind of like working together or in an alliance or maybe even against one another. There's none of that kind of like balance to the system that we have at the moment.
Mm.
And I find that very frustrating.
It is very frustrating. I mean, I think this is similar to what you've just said, really. I think Stephen Daisley, who writes about Scottish matters for The Spectator, argued that effectively you need some sort of widespread constitutional reform in the UK in order to permanently stop the prospect of Scottish independence, because as it stands, we are just moving towards it inexorably, really. Mm. The problem is...
If you were Scottish, would you vote for independence?
That's a good question.
Thank you.
The trouble is that I'm not Scottish, and therefore it's impossible for me to really answer it. I could see that I would find it attractive based on my previous voting disposition. I don't really know. That's a bit because I don't know.
I think it would be, if I were Scottish, I know that independence would be incredibly attractive, because all I see is an England, a more conservative minded England, shackling Scotland's. Brexit is the big thing of where Scotland went one way and England went the other.
Hmm.
And England, because of its size, has shackled Scotland to a Brexit decision. And I can see kind of like the huge injustice there. And also the fact that you have the politics is just a completely different ecosystem north of the border nowadays. It used to be very Labour dominated and hasn't been for a very long time now. The Labour Party in Scotland is an absolute mess. And so now the first opposition to the SNP is Conservatives in Scotland. And it just doesn't... I can very much smell the attractiveness of an independent Scotland if I had that choice.
Mm. I mean, I think there's a lot that's interesting about Scottish independence, but the fact is that sort of attitudinally Scotland and England are pretty close, as you'd expect two countries that have been united for more than 300 years to be. I mean, one thing that does seem to get overlooked is something like 40% of Scots did vote for Brexit, and you know, likewise, more than 40% of English people voted against Brexit. So again, I can see why it's framed in the way you've just framed it, but it's not really accurate, ultimately. Mm. I think it is just true that to actually stop the slide towards Scottish independence, you know, something needs to be done. That said, I don't sense that the Tory government has any particular appetite for a broader constitutional series of reforms. I mean, it's called the Conservative Party for a reason. They're generally opposed to that sort of stuff. I don't really sense there's a huge appetite for devolution per se. That said, on the other side of the ledger, I think the COVID pandemic has in many ways strengthened the hand of a lot of devolved administrations. I mean, Scotland has largely cut its own path in terms of setting out its response to the pandemic, although not as much as the SNP would like you to believe.
And she's been seen to have done very well with it, hasn't she? And Nicola Sturgeon.
She has, although I'm not sure how fair that is in many respects.
Yeah. But she's played it very well. It doesn't really matter how fair it is. It's all about perception politics.
It is all about perception. I mean, likewise, Andy Burnham, who as mayor of Manchester has in reality not a lot of power, has managed to make himself seem like he was negotiating with a foreign government almost.
I was chatting with some friends of mine who are up in Manchester, and he's now being affectionately called Lord of the North.
I mean, we know what happened to the Lord of the North in Game of Thrones, so, you know, hopefully that doesn't...
I actually don't. Is that a Game of Thrones reference? I didn't even fucking know.
I assume it is. But Sean Bean ends up getting his head cut off.
I did know that. Yeah.
So yeah, spoiler alert, but you know, Game of Thrones has been out for a while, so just deal with that, I think. It seems to me that there is actually quite a good opportunity in some ways for some sort of rearrangement of the constitution. I was actually in the Tory manifesto, they said that they would, and this is December 2019 we're talking, they said within a year of forming a government, they would form a constitutional commission, I should say.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's happening, isn't it?
No, it's not. There's been no formal announcement of the commission forming. The only thing they have done is actually...
that questionnaire thing, right? But it was mainly about scrapping the Human Rights Act.
I don't know what you're talking about, actually.
They sent out kind of like a consultation for people to fill out. And I think it was all about like constitutional things, but they worded things like, how much do you hate being restricted by the Human Rights Act? A lot, loads, or a shit ton?
Jazza, I'm always abusing human rights like Priti Patel, and therefore I would very much like to see the Human Rights Act abolished.
I'm so happy for you. But those were not very well-worded, fair social science-affiliated questions.
I see, okay. The only thing I'm aware of that has actually been a sort of move towards constitutional reform has been the independent audit on administrative law, which is actually a review of judicial reviews, which were infamously used against the proroguing process you mentioned before. Among other things. And you know, part of the reason the government doesn't like those things is that they've generally been used to actually soften or try to stop Brexit in the last couple of years, or in their phrase, conduct politics through the courts, which is a case I'm kind of sympathetic to, but it does, you know, it doesn't look good if you're the executive and you're trying to like stop the courts from, you know, checking your movements in various ways. I think there's a legitimate argument around that, but I just think the wider politics around it are not good, and I think that it probably wouldn't be top of my list in terms of reforming how this country's constitution works.
Same.
So yeah, I mean, it's it all seems bad, Jazza, I think, in conclusion. It does all seem bad.
Yeah, they're going to behead the UK in the next few years, aren't they? Do you think that Boris Johnson will actually give them... a lot can happen in politics, but in May we're going to have the... as well as the London local elections and some other local elections, we're going to have the Scottish Holyrood elections.
Oh, yeah.
It's expected that the SNP will regain their majority, and they will then use that mandate to be able to hold another independence referendum. Do you reckon, and the right to do it lands with Boris Johnson?
He has to sign off on it, yeah.
He has to sign off on it. Do you think he will?
No, I don't think so. I don't think he's obliged to. And I tell you, he isn't.
There's nothing that says he has to.
I tell you what you said about the whole Brexit has altered the wider landscape for Scotland in terms of the context of the original independence referendum was that the UK was part of the EU, and at the time it seemed likely that it would remain part of the EU. So I do kind of take all that, but it was also said to be a once in a lifetime vote.
When something as seismic as Brexit happens, I think it's so hard to legitimately make the case that they don't deserve another crack at the whip.
I think you can.
And I'm not just saying that because I really, really want Scottish citizenship, please. Thank you.
I mean, my understanding is that at least the way the SNP laid out originally is if Scotland becomes independent, if you live in the UK, you will be given a right to Scottish citizenship, irrespective of whether you have any real connection to Scotland.
Really?
Per se. That's what they said.
Really?
Whether that transpires, I don't know. But I mean, there will be people who just want another referendum, who view the Tories' government over Scotland as illegitimate because the Tories get barely any votes in Scotland, or barely any seats, I should say, in the Westminster Parliament for Scotland. Those people will never be satisfied one way or the other until they're independent. But I think it's legitimate to say, look, that wasn't a once-in-a-lifetime vote, and this is a kind of in sickness and in health arrangement, as all political unions of this sort are, you know.
Yeah, like... but people divorce after saying that, Jimmy, don't they?
They do, yeah, but I think there's a decent argument there. I realise that some people will disagree with it, but as I said, there's some people that just want another independence referendum. Who would be asking for one irrespective of whether Brexit happened or not?
Look, I don't want Scotland to leave the Union, but I think it's so difficult for there to have been so much that has changed, and if the SNP get a majority in Holyrood, I don't think that you can justify not giving them another crack at it.
I mean, it will be interesting to see, because some people say, oh, you have to give it to them, but you don't, really.
But you don't. You don't.
Yeah.
We were just saying earlier, Boris Johnson and his government don't give a shit. they'll do what they want.
Yeah, I mean, that is, I think that's an argument, that's a point in favour of my prediction that it won't happen. But
I agree. I don't think it will happen either. But then we saw, it makes me think of Catalonia tried to have an independence referendum, held it anyway, and then there was a load of civil unrest for like a few months. So that'll be fun to look forward to for 2021, won't it? Bloody hell.
Nicola Sturgeon has said that she won't hold an unofficial one, but I suppose we'll see. Won't we?
Mm.
We will see.
Righto, shall we wrap up then?
We probably should. Jazza, where can they find you if they want to criticise your terrible opinions?
At Jazza John on all social media platforms.
You can
Apart from TikTok. On TikTok, I'm JazzaJohn_1, I think, or something. Who the fuck knows?
That is very, very, very depressing. The consistent branding has gone right out the window.
But I think I made that TikTok account. That is Jazza John. I just don't know how to access it.
Yeah, we've all been there. You can find me, you can email me at jimmy@rightdishonourable.com.
Oh, exciting.
If you have a mind to. But yeah, other than that, we can wrap up this episode of the podcast.
Sorry, I just burped. I'm sure that got picked up. Anyway, okay, bye.
Bye-bye.